Hello there, and welcome back to The Forum, where science comes to socialize, the one and only podcast of the Institute on Science for Global Policy. My name's Aubrey, and I've got Cleo and Daniela here with me today, as usual, for our bi-weekly chat on topics ranging from food fermentation to the energy grid.
Hi all, it's Cleo here. So what's on the agenda today, Aubrey? GMOs? Vaccines?
Please let it be food. Please let it be food.
That was Daniela, everyone, and I'm guessing she's hungry today.
Whatever. You just had us answer that question on what topic we like talking about the most on our show for our Questions with Co-Hosts initiative. Food episodes are definitely up there for me, so this should be no surprise.
In case you're wondering out there, Daniela is talking about a social media project we do on our Twitter and Facebook pages, in which we give listeners a look at the podcast production from the co-host's very unique perspective.
Check it out on our Twitter at ISGPForum or on our Facebook page, facebook.com/ISGPForum. While you're at it, drop us a comment about today's episode. So, how about it, Aubrey? What are we talking about today?
I'm so glad you asked, Cleo. Sorry, Daniela, but today's topic isn't food. It's actually fire. So, I guess if you consider the fact that we can use fire to cook food, or is that too much of a stretch?
Actually, that's totally fine with me. Because I know if we're talking about fire, that means we're going to be focusing on the policy position paper written by Dr. John Keeley for the 2016 ISGP conference at Sacramento State University called Water and Fire, Impacts of Climate Change. I happen to have a heavy hand in planning this conference, so I'm super down for talking about any of its debates.
Well, Dr. Keeley is a research ecologist for the U.S. Geological Survey and an adjunct professor at UCLA, and his paper was titled Global Warming and Future Fire Regimes.
All right, let's do this. I'm about to sound like a broken record here, since I know I've said in the past that it feels like California is always in a state of drought, but in all honesty, I feel like California is always in a state of battling devastating wildfires.
And unfortunately, your feeling is kind of justified. Regardless, there are some important trends that have been distinguished by scientists that can help us determine if California is at a high risk for wildfires at some arbitrary point in time.
And this becomes particularly important when considering the fact that, as Dr. Keeley puts it, temperature has always been a key factor in wildfire danger indices, and global warming predictions are a major concern. So basically, if current temperatures are bad, higher temperatures are worse, and Smokey the Bear's got a lot of TV commercials to make.
So, what trends can we look to, then, in order to determine whether a particular season is likely to be packed with wildfires? Well, spring and summer temperatures in California have been shown over the past 100 years to have a huge impact on wildfire susceptibility. Autumn and winter temperatures, though? Not so much.
So you're saying there's a seasonal dependence here?
That's exactly what she's saying. There's also an elevation nuance to incorporate, though. This seasonal fire-climate relationship actually only pertains to mountainous coniferous forest ecosystems. So high elevation locations dominated by trees with needle leaves and cones, generally speaking. In the context of California, this description mainly applies to NorCal.
Right. Lower elevations seem to be less impacted by annual temperature changes when it comes to fire frequency, and this includes most of Southern California. That doesn't mean SoCal is resistant to forest fires, though. Not even close. It turns out that the southern part of the state is most susceptible to directly human-caused fires.
California is so weird, too, because it has a huge number of landscape types, making fire management particularly challenging. As it turns out, half the state has done a pretty decent job warding off forest fires, while the other half has left something to be desired.
Today's Best at Not Burning Award goes to Northern California, whose fire management practices have resulted in a smaller number of fires starting than historically recorded.
And on the other hand, Southern California has actually witnessed more fires than recorded in the past, despite the fact that the same fire suppression policies have been in place in both Northern and Southern California.
Since we're about to go all in here in a second, talking about struggles in SoCal, let's take a minute to summarize the current challenges to fire suppression in the northern half of the state. Because, I mean, there are some, despite the fact that they seem to have a bit of a better handle on things than their neighbors.
Fair enough. Northern California's forest systems tend to thrive on periodic, low-intensity fires that don't kill the canopy trees. Yeah, that makes sense. But the severity of fires in NorCal has increased lately, having much to do with the fire suppression policies causing a buildup of organic matter that fuels these very fires.
For instance, certain California forest systems and national park areas haven't experienced fires over the past 125 years, despite the fact that tree ring studies suggest that fire exposure every 10 to 30 years is normal.
It's kind of crazy to think that hardcore preventing fires can actually be a bad thing for the environment, isn't it? It's kind of counterintuitive, but the proof is in the pudding, I guess. If you suppress natural fires too well, you can actually disrupt the ecosystem. Let's get back to business, though. Where does fire management in SoCal stand?
Well, fire management has been so challenging in the southern half of the state, in part because of the high density of chaparral ecosystems, which are characterized by relatively shrubby plants adapted to dry summers and damp winters. Not to mention the fact that humans start more fires in SoCal than NorCal. See, I knew Southern California was all hype.
Okay, Aubrey, you cannot just hate on Southern California just because your fandom for the San Francisco Giants lies heavily on the side of obsession.
Whoa, I'm so not obsessed. It's just a statement of fact, honestly, that the Giants are the superior team with the nicest players that treat their fans like gold, and they essentially, I mean, wait, hold up. You cannot, don't let me do this. Unless you want me to start rambling with stories of meeting players and getting autographs, my appreciation for the Giants is so off limits here.
Appreciation. That's a euphemism if I've ever heard one. Don't pretend like I haven't seen this smattered all over your Instagram, Aubrey.
Okay, you know what? Fine. There are worse things a person could be obsessed with.
Well, I actually can't argue with you there. I mean, you could instead be obsessed with fire, and I imagine that could get a little dangerous, especially in California, you know, with the dryness and the trees and all.
See, I told you.
Well, yes and no, actually. What many people don't realize is that some degree of forest burning is actually natural and helps to maintain ecosystems. Remember, just a minute or two ago, we said that NorCal forests actually like low-intensity fires on occasion? And before our California listeners, yes, we see you, LA and San Diego, go setting their local forest patches ablaze, let's describe why that's so.
As it turns out, most of California's forests have historically witnessed pretty tame understory burning, where the understory in this case is actually defined as plants growing beneath the forest canopy or tallest vegetation, but also that exist above the forest floor.
So, shrubbery and brush go up in flames, and it's okay because these species are adapted to this fire regime. Even the canopy or overstory species are used to a little fire burning at their feet.
Anthropomorphizing trees, gotta love it. In any case, managing these smaller natural burns or even prescribing them is a common strategy for reducing fire hazards and maintaining that particular ecosystem.
And although we know that temperature patterns can be correlated with fire season regimes in certain geographic locations, we don't have a complete understanding about how global warming over the long term will impact fire activity. Could global warming increase the length of the fire season? Or maybe it'll just increase the frequency of fires within the existing fire season. Who knows, really?
Or even more complicated, if either of the previous scenarios came to fruition, how would this change in typical fire regime impact existing ecosystems?
We just said that these plants can deal with fire, though.
Sure, they're able to now. If a common forest plant in California is used to handling 5 fires per year, I'm totally simplifying and generalizing this, but you'll get the point, then who knows how it'll respond to 15 fires? Or if it usually experiences fiery conditions for 3 months out of the year and uses the remaining 9 months to recuperate.
Then how would it respond to 6 months of fire and 6 months of recuperation time? I see your point. How many fires will it take to get to the center of a forest meltdown? The world may never know.
I like what you did there. Additionally, though, the debaters said that even if global warming-induced temperature changes don't directly cause large fires, these temperatures will exacerbate other factors that increase fire risk, like drought, for instance.
I almost forgot about that. They even said that warmer temperatures have increased the severity of the most recent California drought by 10 to 15%. And if drought can increase fire risk, that's almost as good as the temperature increasing the fire risk itself.
Let's also take a step back and note that uncertainties about global warming and fire can really apply to most of the state of California. and can almost certainly be applied to other dry but vegetative parts of the world. There are more difficulties to tease out, though, in Southern California specifically.
What could possibly be more impactful than global warming, though?
Well, how about growing population sizes, for starters?
Ah, yes, since everyone and their mothers wants to be an actor these days, large flocks of people into Southern Cali seems pretty reasonable. We'll have an entire population of Mias from La La Land.
Not exactly what I was going for there. In reality, because humans are responsible for 95% of all fires, the population growth in the SoCal region could really exacerbate unintended forest fires. More people, more fires. It's pretty simple, actually.
Maybe we could use some of that fire to burn down the sets of all the movie remakes and sequels coming out lately. 8 Fast and Furious films, really?
Wait, those are the movies that inspire my podcast episode titles. Don't take those away from me.
Oh gosh.
Maybe that says something. I mean, I'm kidding, sort of. But I understand what you're saying, Aubrey. Dr. Keeley specifies that human activity really dominates the ignition patterns of the southern half of California, and we can reasonably expect this domination to continue if more people live there.
And human exacerbated fires in Southern California have been well correlated with a change in landscape from native shrublands to non-native grasslands. Simply put, ecosystems have changed from the types of vegetation that started out there to really alternative types that, from nature's perspective, probably don't belong there.
The native shrublands, like those chaparral ecosystems we mentioned earlier, actually thrive on periodic high-intensity fires. So essentially, they prefer the exact opposite type of fire compared to NorCal forests. But in recent years, SoCal's native shrublands have been exposed to low-intensity fires, and that is what has really facilitated this change from shrubland to grassland.
This vegetation replacement actually starts a pretty vicious cycle. The non-native grasslands, as we've described them, are more flammable and promote those lower-severity fires compared to the native plant alternatives. And so, boom, now you've got plants that encourage and end up facilitating longer fire seasons.
And more frequent burning. The debaters noted that these exotic grasslands that promote lower intensity fires also induce the fire season to extend from 6 months to, get this, year round. And this results in watershed instability and decreased opportunity for carbon storage in vegetation.
Exactly. A slew of problems arise.
Finally, we complete this feedback loop since this lengthened low-intensity burning increases the amount of conversion from native shrublands to non-native grasslands.
Which, of course, causes more of the burning.
Which causes more landscape conversion.
Which causes everyone to turn off our podcast because we bored them to tears reiterating this cycle.
Okay, totally not necessary, Cleo. Daniela and I were simply making a point. It's pretty hard to get a cycle like this to stop once it's allowed to really get going.
Sure, sure. So we need to keep the cycle from really getting going, as you put it. So how's it done?
Okay, so first with a little background before we get into the policy issues here. We've dwelled on good old Cali a bunch today, but it turns out that California's wildfires only comprise a small portion of total acreage burned annually in the western United States.
Even so, most of the federal fire suppression budget is spent on California specifically.
Seems totally unfair, right? Well, there's rationale here that's worth explaining. In Southern California, huge and densely populated metropolitan areas exist pretty much right next to dry, fire-prone chaparral forest. Or, as I like to put it, fire food.
And the federal investment in a fire-free, or at least fire-reduced, California makes a little more sense when considering the fact that this particular state loses an average of 1,000 homes each year to wildfires, mostly in its southern half.
So where do fire management policies come into play? Well, Dr. Keeley breaks current and needed policies into two categories based on landscape, forested and non-forested ecosystems.
When it comes to forested ecosystems, again, existing mainly in Northern California, we really need to draw on some things we talked about at the beginning of the episode. Sometimes forested ecosystems kind of end up missing fires that they actually needed, often due to historical fire suppression policies.
As a result, Cleo's fire food builds up in these forests because smaller, manageable fires that would consume the leafy, twiggy, or otherwise dry fuels haven't happened. Now, these areas are at risk for high-intensity fires that are way harder and sometimes almost impossible to keep under control. Not to mention the fact we pointed out earlier, that NorCal forests prefer low-intensity burns.
For this reason, policies in forested ecosystems need to include prescription burning. And in accordance with the terminology, you can kind of think of these small, intentional, managed burns as medicine to keep the forest healthy.
It's not quite that simple, though, because air quality rules make managed burns, as well as unintended wildfires, of course, non-trivial. For this reason, mechanical treatments can sometimes be effective for reducing the presence of surface fuels, including leaves and wood, as well as so-called ladder fuels, like young and/or short trees.
Mechanical treatments, for those who are wondering, include the straight-up removal of small trees from the ground, or even grinding up said small trees or shrubs. Private companies actually purchase the rights to remove the timber, but getting companies to actually buy in can be pretty challenging.
Because large trees that have diameters greater than 30 inches can't be harvested. That's why the debaters recommended that state and federal agencies actively seek ways to make mechanical forest thinning more cost-effective for private industry.
Nonetheless, according to scientific reviews, mechanical treatments in conjunction with prescribed fires can help to reduce future fire risks without causing problems for understory plants, soil erosion, biodiversity, or carbon storage. That info comes from the California Fire Science Consortium, by the way.
Okay, so that covers the forested ecosystems. Let's delve into Dr. Keeley's assessment of policies for non-forested ecosystems now. For starters, non-forested ecosystems are the shrublands we mentioned earlier. You know, the ones that are often replaced by grasslands in SoCal after fires.
Unfortunately, the fire potential of these shrublands is probably not as well understood as it could be. And Dr. Keeley asserts that this is because the California State Legislature only mandates resource assessment of trees and rangeland. So, naturally, it'd be helpful to tease out these details, considering both the impact of global warming and human population growth when it comes to shrubland fire risk.
Our presenter also discussed the importance of recognizing a connection between land use planning and fire prevention in these shrubby regions.
Right, and I'm sure you could guess a handful of reasons why this would be the case, but we'll give you an example for reference.
So most fires in Southern California that end up becoming catastrophic originate somewhere in the interior of the state, and then they're driven outward toward the coast by the Santa Ana winds.
Therefore, increased development and human existence in these interior regions of the state should, in theory, increase the number or size of catastrophic fires that'll spread westward. So before we start letting tons of wannabe Californians start building houses and such in these areas, policymakers might just want to think twice and take action before letting that happen.
More specifically, debaters recommended that state and federal agencies work closely with local planners in order to discourage development in areas with high fire risks.
Sure, but development isn't always going to be preventable. And limiting public access to certain forest areas via road closures is pretty unpopular, not to mention difficult to enforce.
Well, even if development was preventable or limiting access was easy, it doesn't change the fact that a lot of development already exists in the interior of Southern California.
You know, you're right about that, Cleo. And that's why strategies have been hashed out to deal with the problem we've identified here today. The strategy that seems most appreciated, according to Dr. Keeley, is the, quote, house out model of fire management. And in this, basically, the greatest focus is placed at the wildlife-urban interface. And then the focus really kind of, I guess, dissipates as you move away from civilization and more into the wilderness.
This and other strategies, including vegetation treatments, such as those quote-unquote mechanical processes we mentioned earlier, should be further examined in non-forested landscapes to determine empirically which fire hazard reduction strategies are most effective.
And I guess in general, policies need to consider the different landscapes of the northern and southern halves of California when assigning fire reduction strategies. As we've said for many episodes on many topics now, there's no one-size-fits-all policy here.
The debaters seem to agree that, in the end, Northern California should focus on reducing the density of fire food via prescribed burns and mechanical treatments, while Southern California, on the other hand, really needs to focus on the human element of ignitions.
I had no idea that fire food would catch on like this.
I don't know, man. I'm kind of feeling it. Maybe everyone else will too. Hashtag fire food, everyone. Anyway, before we wrap things up today, I think we should finish up with a pretty sobering but interesting thought. We've talked so much about how climate change can potentially impact fires, but how about this? How can fires impact climate change?
That doesn't even seem like a thing.
Oh, but it is a thing. Think about it. What happens when wood burns?
I heat up a cup of hot chocolate, extra marshmallows, and snuggle up with a book.
No, weirdo. Carbon dioxide is released into the atmosphere, and scientists have concluded that high concentrations of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere result in climate change.
And we're no strangers to witnessing wildfires contributing heavily to greenhouse gas concentrations. In fact, the debaters mentioned as an example, the Rim Fire of 2013, it was the largest, highest severity wildfire in the Sierra Nevadas. This blaze emitted, and get this, as much greenhouse gas into the atmosphere that the California Global Warming Solutions Act of 2006 sought to reduce over a 2.5 year period. So all of that progress gone to waste.
So weird to think that I actually never thought of that relationship between fire and climate change before. But it, you know, does make a lot of sense logically.
Okay, so now that we've teased out both directions of this two-way climate and fire street, is it time to close out the show for today?
Seems reasonable.
Alrighty, so today we've discussed the current wildfire situation in the state of California. As it turns out, fire management strategies can be employed uniformly across the state, but successful fire management will involve the use of different strategies in the northern and southern portions of California.
That's because the landscapes of NorCal and SoCal are pretty different, especially in terms of native vegetation. Wildfire frequency and intensity are most likely to be impacted by temperature changes in Northern California, while human activity is actually the most significant driver of fire pattern changes in Southern California.
These differences have impacted fire occurrence across the state and also need to be considered when designing fire management policies.
Based on the landscape and fire patterns of Northern and Southern California, what prevention strategies do you think should be prioritized in each half of the state? Prescribed burns versus mechanical treatments? Independent techniques? Or are they best performed in tandem?
Let us know on Twitter by tagging your post with hashtag ISGPForum, or on Facebook by searching ISGP's The Forum.
As always, we at the Institute on Science for Global Policy anxiously await your comments and questions.
All right. Well, I think that just about sums up the discussion of today's hot topic. Get it? Hot topic. Fire. Burning.
Oh, my God.
You know the Sean Paul song? We be burning.
Okay. Watch me skillfully ignore that punchline. As always, we'd like to thank our listeners for socializing with science today, and we'll catch you next time right here on the forum.
The Institute on Science for Global Policy, or ISGP, is a nonprofit organization that convenes international meetings bringing together scientists, policymakers, industry leaders, students, and other stakeholders to discuss pertinent scientific issues facing society. The ISGP has no opinions and does not lobby. Therefore, the preceding podcast reflects the views expressed by the presenters and debaters at our conference. For more information, please visit our website at www.scienceforglobalpolicy.org. Thank you.